Chapter 13. The day before the Arizona and Michigan primaries, the Lake campaign unleashed a media blitz, the likes of which had never been seen before in presidential politics. For 18 hours, the two states were bombarded with one ad after another. Some were 15 seconds, little softies with not much more than his handsome face and the promises of decisive leadership and a safer world. Others were one-minute documentaries on the dangers of the post-Cold War. Still others were macho, in-your-face promises to the terrorists of the world. Kill people simply because they are Americans and you will pay a very dear price. Cairo was still very fresh, and the assurances hit their mark. The ads were bold, put together by high-powered consultants, and the only downside was oversaturation. But Lake was too new to the scene to bore anyone, not now, anyway. His campaign spent $10 million on television in the two states, a staggering amount. They ran at a slower clip during voting hours on Tuesday, February 22nd. And when the polls closed, the exit analysts predicted Lake would win his home state and run a close second in Michigan. Governor Terry, after all, was from Indiana, another Midwestern state, and he'd spent weeks in Michigan during the previous 3 months. Evidently, he hadn't spent enough time there. The voters in Arizona opted for their native son, and those in Michigan liked the new fellow, too. Lake got 60% at home, and 55% in Michigan, where Governor Terry got a paltry 31%. The balance was divided among the non-contenders. It was a devastating loss for Governor Terry, just 2 weeks before Big Super Tuesday and 3 weeks before the little one. Lake watched the vote counting from onboard his airplane, en route from Phoenix, where he'd voted for himself. An hour from Washington, CNN declared him the surprise winner in Michigan, and his staff opened the champagne. He savored the moment, even allowed himself two glasses. History was not lost on Lake. No one had ever started so late and come so far so fast. In the darkened cabin, they watched the analysts on four screens, the experts all marveling at this man Lake and what he'd done. Governor Terry was gracious, but also worried about the enormous sums of money being spent by his heretofore unknown opponent. Lake chatted politely with the small group of reporters waiting for him at Reagan National Airport, then rode in yet another black Suburban to his national campaign headquarters, where he thanked his highly paid staff and told them to go home and get some sleep. It was almost midnight when he got to Georgetown, to his quaint little row house on 34th near Wisconsin. Two Secret Service agents got out of the car behind Lake, and two more were waiting on the front steps. He had adamantly refused an official request to put guards inside his home. "I do not want to see you people lurking around here," he said harshly at his front door. He resented their presence, didn't know their names, and didn't care if they disliked him. They had no names, as far as he was concerned. They were simply "you people," said with as much contempt as possible. Once he was locked inside, he went upstairs to his bedroom and changed his clothes. He turned out the lights as if he were asleep, waited 15 minutes, then eased downstairs to the den to see if anyone was looking in, then down another flight to the small basement. He climbed through a window and stepped into the cold night near his tiny patio. He paused, listened, heard nothing, then quietly opened a wooden gate and darted between the two buildings behind his. He surfaced on 35th Street, alone in the dark, dressed like a jogger with a running cap pulled low to his brow. 3 minutes later, he was on M Street, in the crowds. He found a taxi and disappeared into the night. Teddy Maynard had gone to sleep reasonably content with his candidate's first two victories, but he was awakened by the news that something had gone wrong. When he rolled himself into the bunker at 10 minutes after 6 a.m., he was more frightened than angry, though his emotions had run the gamut in the past hour. York was waiting, along with a supervisor named DeVille, a tiny, nervous man who'd obviously been wired for many hours. "Let's hear it," Teddy growled, still rolling and looking for coffee. DeVille did the talking. At 12:02 this morning, he said goodbye to the Secret Service and entered his house. At 12:17, he exited through a small window in the basement. We, of course, have wires and timers on every door and window. We've leased a row house across the street, and we were on alert anyway. He hasn't been home in 6 days. DeVille waved a small pill, the size of an aspirin. This is a little device known as a T-deck. They're in the soles of all his shoes, including his jogging shoes. So if he's not barefoot, we know where he is. Once pressure is applied from the foot, the bug emits a signal that is broadcast for 200 yards without a transmitter. When pressure is relaxed, it will continue to provide a signal for 15 minutes. We scrambled and picked him up on M Street. He was dressed in sweats with a cap over his eyes. We had two cars in place when he jumped in a cab. We followed him to Chevy Chase, to a suburban shopping center. While the cab waited, he darted into a place called Mailbox America, one of those new places where you can send and receive mail outside the postal service. Some, including this one, are open 24 hours for mail pickup. He was inside for less than a minute, just long enough to open his box with a key, remove several pieces of mail, throw it all away, then return to the cab. One of our cars followed him back to M Street, where he got out and sneaked back home. The other car stayed at the mailbox place. We went through the waste can just inside the door and found 6 pieces of junk mail, evidently his. The address is Al Conyers, Box 455, Mailbox America, 39380 Western Avenue, Chevy Chase.
So he didn't find what he was looking for? Teddy asked.
It looks as though he tossed everything he took from his box. Here's the video.